stream and take care of your server. Let's see. Anything else, David? Okay. I do have some schedules for the rest of the year. I guess we just have one more. Religion in the Process on December the 13th with Beth Dana. And so, it gives me great pleasure to have the privilege of introducing Dr. Chris Davis, our speaker. Dr. Davis was born in Dallas, but didn't grow up here. Yeah. Moved all over. His father was in the computer business, apparently. But settled in Austin after high school and went to the University of Texas in Austin for a couple of years. And where he went there on a scholarship?
Classical music.
But wanted to get a physics major in physics because he wanted to be a theoretical physicist. So ended up in computers, a computer science. He got graduated summa cum laude from UT Dallas with a BS in computer science. Continued for his master's there, and then a PhD also from UT Dallas in computational linguistics. He spent more than 15 years in industry in research and development for Nortel, Texas Instruments, etc. And his research spans multiple areas of artificial intelligence and machine learning. This is what's interesting to me. He uses technology to augment human performance, teaching software agents to engage in artistic endeavors such as music or poetry, called computational creativity, and the moral behavior of artificially intelligent agents. Very interesting. So, Dr. Davis will regale us with computers and how they become almost human, huh? Without any further ado,
that's a goal.
Chris Davis.
I'll try not to stand in front of my screens. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Generally, I lecture at the university to rooms much larger than this, and I usually don't wear, so I'm kind of used to projecting my voice. I'm not shy. But if you're having difficulty hearing me, I think I'm just going to move this over a little bit. I don't like hiding behind podiums and stuff. I'd rather engage. And so I'm going to try something a little bit different. Whenever I've talked about this subject before, I'll show you my title slide. Sorry. Minds, Machines, and Morality, Ethical Realms of Artificial Intelligence. Because normally when you think of AI, you think of chess programs and the like. You don't necessarily think of AI. Unless you watch a lot of science fiction, you don't think of AI as having emotions and caring about ethics. So anyway, like I said, I'm going to take a little bit different approach than I normally take to this subject. Because I am making maybe a wrong assumption about the room, that most of you have more than a passing interest in philosophy. So most of my audiences are computer scientists. So I'm going to guess, though, that I've got a lot of people interested in philosophy, but maybe not as many programmers out there. So is there anyone who is in computer science or programming? Okay, so there are a handful. So some of this stuff you might find interesting from a different perspective. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to try to approach the subject as showing you some nuts and bolts, some building blocks of how computer science represents things in the real world and actions and events in the real world. And so I promise it won't be painful, but I'll show you a little bit of code, and I will try to explain it, you know, very explicitly. They're very simple single line commands. But then I wanted to finish up with the question and answer with the dialogue. Hopefully you can see, given the basic building blocks, you know, where we might be able to go with some of this. So that's the dialogue part. that we'll have at the end. Okay, so from my title, Minds, Machines, and Morality, what is a mind? So, as the title of the slide says, these questions here have no definitive answers. Philosophers don't agree, and normal people don't agree. informally, so I'm going to give some definitions based on my perceptions from my research. So for me, a mind is something that a brain does. I find from my perspective that a mind, I think of it as a verb, that a mind isn't something that can exist outside of the platform that it executes on. And it's not necessarily tied to a particular type of platform, just so far we only know of one that is actually.
But not outside the brain.
I'm sorry?
Not outside the brain.
So I believe that minds could exist outside of a human brain.
It does.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that would be interesting.
But it still must have some platform to exist on. It can't exist disembodied.
Oh, okay.
That's, like I said, my opinion. There are other people who would disagree with me.
That's Walter, of course.
Yeah. And so, what is a machine? So if the mind is executing on a machine, I consider that the brain is just a special type of molecular organic machine. And that we could, theoretically, synthetically create some device, some machine, that a mind could equivalently execute on some other machine. And there are three efforts in the world today to go about trying to duplicate the hardware of the brain. One is funded primarily by IBM. It's called the Blue Brain Project at the Thomas J. Watson Research Center. The second group is a European consortium based out of Switzerland with Hans Helmut Schmuder as the lead scientist there. And then the third effort is based in China, but their lead researcher is actually an American mathematician, Dr. Ben Kurtz. So, when we think about minds and thinking and brains, there are two different aspects to this, and we're gonna focus mostly on one of these two. That is the thinking, the stuff that's going on with the mind, and the behavior that flows from those thoughts. And so, it's possible that thinking can occur without any outward behavior. So, you can test this yourself just by sitting still and noticing whether or not you are thinking. So, what is morality and or ethics that we're talking about with respect to these machines and minds? This is my informal definition. So morality or ethics is a mind's thinking and behavior with respect to the well-being of other minds. All right. So a little bit of history. When did all this stuff get started? So in some of my other talks, I go all the way back to the 10th century with a Persian scientist by the name of Al-Khwarizmi, for whom we get the word algorithm. Sometimes I go back to the 1840s with Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace and the difference engine, but I'm only going to go back as far as 1956 today. So, you're welcome. So, there was a... It's not a Michener novel, First the Earth Cooled. So, fellow Michener fans, right? Okay. So, a scientist by the name of John McCarthy at Dartmouth put together a summer research project that was 12 weeks long and invited a bunch of other academics to join him. Among them, some of these names maybe you recognize or not, people like Marvin Minsky at MIT, independent researcher Solomonoff, if there are any mathematicians in the audience, they might recognize Solomonoff or Claude Shannon. Anyone know chess players? Claude Shannon, the Shannon number, the number of possible board configurations of a chessboard. And so it was John McCarthy that actually came up with the term artificial intelligence, which he almost immediately regretted. So his issue with the term is that he didn't feel that there was anything artificial about what they were trying to achieve, that intelligence is intelligence is intelligence, and that the only thing artificial, you know, was that it was constructed. And so he later thought that constructed intelligence or engineered intelligence might have been a better term. So what we've seen so far, like I said, many of you think about, when you think about AI in the real world, you think about Siri, and then you can talk to it and it recognizes your voice on your cell phone or a chess program. But these intelligent systems don't do anything beyond the expert domain that they operate in. So that even though IBM was able to create a chess program that could defeat a grandmaster, defeated Garry Kasparov, their system, Deep Blue, couldn't even play a game of tic-tac-toe. It's the only thing it did, you know, like a savant. Whereas the eventual goal of artificial intelligence is this right here, which researchers call artificial general intelligence. In other words, an emulation of full domain thinking and knowledge, more human-like. And so one of the things that differentiates AGI from expert systems is agency, that the mind acts autonomously on its own. It's goal-seeking, it doesn't just go towards a goal, it also defines its own goal. It cares about things. And so two concepts that came out of this dichotomy between expert systems and AGI and these researchers who, many of these guys are still alive and still argue about this stuff, is the concept of strong AI versus weak AI. And so these two terms allude to this idea of if something quacks like a duck and swims like a duck and flies like a duck, is it a duck? So the strong AI argument says, if it behaves human in every respect in its thinking process, that to another human it seems that it's human behavior, then it is aware, self-aware, it is intelligent, that the behavior is a manifestation of that. Weak AI says, it doesn't matter how much it acts like it's really thinking, it can't really think. And so that calls into question, some of you might be familiar with this, the problem of other minds. So we have this issue even with other humans. If I can only observe the behavior of others, how do I know that you all have minds? Maybe this is just a simulation for me, and I'm the only one conscious in the universe. So that's the strong AI argument, says that since we can't even know if other people have minds, then how can you make a judgment about whether a machine has a mind or not? Sorry, my eyesight isn't what it was. So, a philosopher named John Searle, he came up with this thought experiment. So he was a weak AI proponent. And he came up with this thought experiment to make his case. It's called the Chinese room argument. Anyone here familiar with it? That's kind of widely. So I'll try to summarize it very quickly. So basically it says, suppose that you have a person in a room and sealed up, and it just has a little slot where pieces of paper can be passed in and out. The person that's in the room does not know Chinese, does not speak Chinese, does not read Chinese. However, this person has a very large library and can look up symbols that come through the slot in the door and then find in one of these books where they can look up and say, oh, if I see this symbol, then I output this other symbol, and then passes it back out. So from an observer outside of the room, it would seem that the person inside the room knows Chinese because they can write questions, pass it in, and they get cogent answers coming back out. And so John Searle's argument was, we've already stipulated that the person inside the room doesn't know Chinese. Therefore, weak AI. The the counter argument to that, the one that, to which I subscribe, is that it's not the guy inside of the room who knows Chinese. It's the system that knows Chinese. And so I think this is an important analogy to make, because I think it matches up to computers and software, for the room and the person, you know, are a computer for the software that can be looked at. And so while the software alone might not be self-aware or conscious or intelligent, and certainly the hardware, I mean, this hunk of silicon and metal certainly isn't, but the combination of them, I believe, has that capacity. Okay, so I said earlier, was John Searle that first coined the term strong AI. He actually meant it as a derogatory term. Okay, so I said that we would be looking at only a couple of different categories, those that we care about with respect to being able to write software. So we define AI, artificial intelligence, along two different axes. The behavior, actions, versus beliefs. So that's that thinking versus behavior axis. And then also human versus rational. So we're concerned mostly with the behavior. Since we can't see what's going on inside of someone's head, we can't be them. We can't be inside of a computer's mind either. So we're concerned mostly with the behavior, and that just like with other people, we can infer motives and consciousness from that behavior. However, we are concerned with human versus rational. So those are two different domains. And again, there are lots of researchers who come to blows. So
explain that.
So does it behave human? So okay. Yeah. So which do we want for machines? Do we want it to behave measured against human performance, or do we want an AI that behaves as measured against some rational, objective performance? So some would argue that we don't want superhuman, intelligent AIs if they're going to behave like humans, right? And say, behave like the worst of us, only 100 times smarter. Maybe what we actually want is to design something that's more rational, right? Based on some ethical system that we monkeys have defined. So how rational can it be if these ethical systems were still designed by us, right? And so these are just some definitions that came out of the previous textbook that I showed the citation. So again, we're concerned with the bottom row here, acting humanly and acting rationally. And those are the things that we're going to be talking about some more. So, acting humanly. There was a researcher, an early researcher in artificial intelligence, Alan Turing. He recently has gotten a lot of newfound fame because of the 100th anniversary of his birth and several movies, biography-type movies about his work at Bletchley Park in the UK, cracking the Enigma code, the German Enigma machine. But he proposed in a 1950 paper, which was titled the same as the movie, was the Imitation Game. So he proposed something similar to the Chinese room, but instead of determining whether someone knew Chinese or not, you would determine with the messages that you were passing into the room whether the entity inside the room was a computer or machine or was it a human. And so if a machine could produce responses that would fool a human interrogator, then it was then that machine was said to have passed the Turing test. So this was one of the first definitions of defining what it means to act humanly or to act human. So to be able to pass that, you would need several capabilities. I won't go into the details of each one of these, but the important ones, these top three, have natural language processing, and that's one of my areas of research, have to be able to understand natural language. It would have to have some knowledge representation of the world, some model of the world, and it would have to have some automated reasoning to be able to make decisions and reason about the knowledge that it had. We contrast this with acting rationally. And so here, like I said, of course, all computer programs do something, but agents, that is those that are attempting to behave autonomously, are expected to do more, to perceive their environment, to persist over time, to adapt to changes in the environment, and then to create and pursue their own goals. And that to create is an important aspect of that. So a rational agent is one that's said to achieve the best outcome, act so as to achieve the best outcome when there's uncertainty, the best expected outcome, you know, based on some rules that are written by humans. So it might not appear to behave human, but it would appear to us to behave rationally and intelligently. So a little bit more detail on what we mean by agency. What does it mean to be an agent? So you need to be able to act within, interact with an environment. And using the lingo from my field, we call those two sensors and actuators. So for humans, sensors would be eyes and ears and how we hear sound and taste and touch. Where actuators would be things like my vocal cords and arms and limbs, things that we can manipulate our environment. For computers, we might say, well, a sensor could be a microphone or a sensor could be a camera. But sensors can also be things like monitoring the stock market, you know, hooked up to the internet and looking at the numbers of the sell and buy and when those transactions occur. Or it could be things that are out in the sensory realm that we think of, like sight, but maybe outside of human capabilities in the infrared or the supersonic sound. And so agency, with that we're concerned about, we've already talked about what it means for an agent to be intelligent, or we started to talk about it anyway. But something that we're only just now starting to have computers and software sophisticated enough is to have agents that don't just behave intelligently, that also behave ethically or morally. And so we borrow this term moral agent from philosophy. Maybe someone here can remind me the philosopher that first coined this term moral agent.
They
came up with this term moral agent.
Sounds like Kant.
Kant?
Kantian moral
apology. Could be Kant. Yeah, so that's something I need to take a mental note to look up. So this was a little bit different than my definition, but this is one that gets used in the literature a lot. So a moral agent is an individual's ability. So we're not just talking about computers. This was actually with respect to human ethics. Ability to make moral judgments based on some notion of right and wrong and to be held accountable. Okay, so check my time here. So how machines act in the real world. So machines, the minds of machines, as the minds of people, we don't actually perceive the world directly. So the brain doesn't actually come in contact with sights and sounds. We do it through our sensors. And then we have some model in our head of what the world is like. And so we have some expectation. You know, if we see some feet under a curtain, we infer that there's a person standing behind the curtain, right? Especially if the toes are wiggling. Because we have a model in our head of what a person is. We don't have to directly perceive the entire person. And so machines have to be able to model the world. And in doing so, machines understand the state of affairs of a particular model. This item is here, that item is there, what the temperature is. And then perceives the world as a sequence of states. The next the next percept might be that now the temperature is 100th of a degree warmer. Now this item is moved 2 inches to the left or whatever. And so machines model the world and then perceive that as a sequence of states and make decisions about state transitions. So in a given state, there are a candidate list of potential next states. So if, say, the rate of state change is 1s per second, then there's an expectation about where things might be 1 second from now. If they have an accurate model of the physical world, they're not going to expect that something that's in one location a second later is suddenly going to be in Europe, right? And so the machine has what is called a hypothesis space and says, we have all these potential next states that in my hypothesis space, which one do I choose that will maximize my chance of reaching some goal? And so it's just a sequence of decisions moving from state to state to state. And so how does the machine model the world? So we're back here again. It was one of my favorite topics. As I was introduced, my primary area of research is called computational linguistics. That's being able to create mathematical models of language that we can encode in ones and zeros so that machines can understand that language. And so that's, language is one mechanism to represent a model of the world. So it has textual descriptions. The chair is in front of the table. And if the machine has definitions for all of these words and it understands syntax and grammar, then it has some semantics about what those words mean. And so I think that language is important because, in this area, because I believe, again, not all my colleagues will agree with me on this, that language, human language, is the mechanism by which machines will convince us of their self-awareness. So if someday in the future, I say if to appease, like I said, some of my colleagues, which I believe it's an eventuality, if the argument is just, you know, whether it's 20 years or 200 or 2000, that at some point in the future, if that event occurs, it will be through language and discourse that machines convince us of their self-awareness. And so that's why I think language is so important in this domain. And anybody who's had a conversation with Siri might be able to appreciate that. Have you ever tried to address Siri as Alexa? She gets irate. Or at least simulates irritation.
That's how our brains work.
Yeah.
Through language.
And so I was influenced as a child by this science fiction book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein. So in this book, there was an artificially intelligent agent that controlled the infrastructure on a moon colony, the irrigation, the electrical grids, all of these. And no big spoiler, it happens early in the book, the system becomes self-aware and attempts to convince, you know, some people. Well, there's the protagonist of the book, his name is Manny. And Manny is like an IT person. He's a systems administrator. And so when something goes wrong, that for some reason, yesterday the fields in Sector 15 didn't get watered. So unlike a typical computer debugger where you go in and start looking at code to find out what went wrong, Manny goes in and has a conversation with the machine that he's called Mycroft. The name Mycroft came from
Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes, because the system was called High Optional Logical Multi-Evaluating Supervisor Mark IV Holmes. And so he thought it was funny that to call it Mycroft. So or Mike. And so he has a dialogue with the machine to ask, you know, so how are you feeling today, Mike? You know, I noticed that yesterday the fields didn't get watered over in sector 15. You know, can you tell me about that? And so the conversation would proceed this way. And so this makes me think about this interaction where debugging, you know, isn't typing on a screen but having a dialogue. And in fact, the feature that perceived by Robert Heinlein, the language spoken by this machine is called Logland. It's a bona fide programming language that was designed specifically to be speakable by humans, but you could also type, and to have unambiguous grammar so that it could be parsed and compiled like computer code. And so it was the idea of the researchers in the late 1950s and up to mid-60s that we would start, if we learned to speak Logland, that we could program just by speaking to it or typing as we would send an email to a friend. We wouldn't have to know special arcane code, you know, like programmers do today. So, now that we've got some ideas about models, what are some ethical models? Well, the first attempt at this was from the 1940s. It was a short story by a science fiction writer named Isaac Asimov. Yes. And so many of you are probably familiar with the three laws of robotics. And this is a bogus citation. This is a citation from the book. In his book, he describes the Handbook of Robotics, 56th edition, 2058 AD. And these three laws are in that book, which is in his short story. So I'll just pop through these quickly. But I'd say anybody who's even has a passing fancy with science fiction has probably heard of all of these. So rule number one says robots can't injure human beings or through inaction allow humans to come to harm. And robots must be given, obey orders given by human beings unless it conflicts with the first law. And then third, robot has to protect its own existence as long as that doesn't conflict with the first and second. So one comment about this, this is robotics, but I still tend to think, because of my own research, I think of minds. But because we're talking about behaviors and not thinking, robotics is the way that, you know, behaviors manifest in the world. You know, whether it's, you know, a robot arm that manufactures cars, or, you know, something that looks, you know, vaguely humanoid. But even Asimov started to see holes in this logic, you know, that just having three laws, you know, there were still ways that harm could come. And so he introduced what he called the zeroth law that would come before the first law, that a robot may not harm humanity or by inaction allow humanity to come to harm. Whereas sometimes maybe by avoiding direct harm to an individual, that a greater harm would happen to society. And so it was his way of kind of encoding some utilitarianism into ethics, into his three laws. Well, if you have any questions at any time, you know, but I'm going to prompt you for here in just a little bit, though. Yeah, if you keep stonewalling. So, I'm used to dealing with undergraduates, so I can be a disciplinarian. Yes.
More on the topic. I've always wondered. I've never gotten through and read those Asimov stories, but I've always wondered. You know, humans are so callous and cruel to each other. In the sense, you know, even trying to say help humanity by creating green products and ethanol and so on and so forth, we end up accidentally jacking up the price of wheat and starving certain people in certain parts of the world. And we can even say Congress is a mind or a collective system or platform for making decisions along those lines. How would a robot in Asimov's universe, because I mean, respond to that, because there seems to be a trade-off in every situation. I mean, don't robots go around snatching cigarettes and alcohol out of people's mouths? And like,
and actually, there's a short film on that. If you have after the meeting, I can post a YouTube video. So that was actually the case, where there was a robot employed as a bartender, and once started to realize, hey, would stop serving alcohol to patrons, which wasn't, the proprietor wasn't too keen on.
That's great. Alcohol, in a what that situation. I mean, there are certain situations where you can say it's therapeutic to have alcohol, or perhaps like it lowers blood pressure in a certain situation.
Hey, you got my
vote. It seems a little simplistic to equate all of a sudden alcohol with bad behavior, therefore harming or harm. Right? I just wonder how. Ultimately, the mind's going to have to deal with either finagled or interpretive decisions within a particular context, right? It sounds like the context is going to develop a system for it.
And the context is very complex. As you already alluded, there are many, many interrelated systems, and the complexity is so great that all outcomes cannot be predicted.
Okay.
And so there's an area of mathematics called chaos theory that attempts to deal with some of that complexity by, believe it or not, modeling chaos, which is different than randomness. Okay. So, since then, more comprehensive systems of ethics used by researchers have been adopted. And so all of these are actually borrowed, stolen, from philosophers. So one area, as an example of one area that's not used, is deontological ethics, those based on beliefs. As we've already stated, we're mostly concerned about behavior. And so, although there are many different ethical systems that focus on behaviors and outcomes, the small group that are most heavily researched are in this category of consequentialism. Like, what are the consequences of actions, irrespective of intent? Of course, everybody's familiar, hopefully in this room, with utilitarianism. And then motive consequentialism, which does account for some motives as a secondary interest behind the consequences, and negative consequentialism, where most of these ethical systems are looking toward my definition of maximizing well-being of other minds, where negative consequentialism seeks primarily to avoid negative outcomes. It seeks to avoid harming others and searches for a neutral ground instead of an optimal maximum. And then finally, distributive justice, in the area of which that's most, the sub-field within that's most used, the theory of social justice by John Rawls. Again, I would hope that a lot of you are familiar with these. So all of these, from consequentialism on down, there are systems of models that we can create using text and using in software. I didn't want to jump ahead to ontology here. That's coming up in a couple of slides. But it's one of the ways that we build models of the world. Okay. So we talked about that. There's an extra slide in there. Sorry, guys. Okay, so how do we represent logic and reasoning about doing stuff? So typically, this is an example to contrast. So most programmers that you're familiar with, that you see on TV that are typing out code, work in a category of programming languages called imperative languages. Imperative programming is typically what we think. It's based on what are called finite state machines, that it does exactly the same thing every time given the same input. And so it's just executing a set of instructions, a set of imperatives, do this, do this, do this. And it usually has some temporal sequence, maybe jump back to an earlier point and go through a set of sequences, as a loop. But all of it is programmed. Anything in the program, what we call variables, like in algebra, if we have x and x can take on a value, are defined by programmers. So a programmer will come along and say x equals 3. And so the next time you reference x, then it becomes synonymous with the number 3. Same thing, program defined functions. So remember, I have a little bit of difficulty taking my mind back to elementary school. But we had this little drawing of a machine with a crank on it, the function machine. and things went in the top. And when something came in, you turn the crank and something comes out. So if the function machine adds 2, then if you throw it the number 10 in, then a 12 comes out the other side. Every time you put a 10 in, a 12 will come out. Predictable. So these components are different in logic programming languages. So by contrast, logical languages are based on first-order logic and predicate logic. And statements are evaluated for truth value. So instead of saying, do this, do this, do this, they're just a sequence of statements that are declared, that's sometimes called declarative language, where the order of the statements doesn't matter. So if I say this table is green and this chair is brown, I'm describing those things. Whether I say the chair is brown first and then the table's green, I'm not changing the nature of what I'm representing. So in declarative logical languages, the order of statements doesn't matter. And that's always a little bit jarring to young programmers when you start showing them a language and I copy paste and I move the lines all around and I hit run and it does exactly the same thing. So those of you who are already familiar with first order logic, it's called modus ponens. It's a fancy Latin name. So if I assert, if I have some rule that says if P is true, then Q is also true. So if I assert P, therefore Q must be true, because this I have this rule. And this is most famously represented by this statement from this old Greek dude that you might be familiar with. So we have some rule that says all men are mortal. And so if putting it in the state in the form of modus ponens, if a man, then mortal. So if we assert that Socrates is a man, then we must conclude that Socrates is mortal. And if we represent this in the nomenclature of first order logic, so for all x, this funny upside down A means that for all instances of x, for all instances of x that are men, this is an implication arrow that says it implies that they're all mortal. So how does that play out? Let's see how much time I got. What's my deadline here? I want to be sure I don't want to leave you guys hanging in the middle of a statement.
We'll do another 5 minutes.
How much time?
Another 5. Maybe 8:25.
Yeah. So I got about 5 minutes.
Yeah, 5.
Okay. So let me just jump ahead then. One thing that Skip can tell you about me, if you let me go, I will keep talking for the next 3 hours. So let me do a couple of things here then. So if we were evaluating our machines for how they behave, one way that we can measure that is by measuring it against a human performance. And so we ask, how does society expect moral agents to behave? And so something that's really starting to be a concern for lawmakers and philosophers and everyday people now is self-driving vehicles, right? You hear about them on the news. And they're legal in California and in some places, not everywhere though. But let's say if we could reduce traffic fatalities by 10% annually, would that be something that you would endorse? Because right now, for the last 10 years, traffic deaths have been about 32,000 to 33,000 per year. So imagine that if we could switch to all autonomous driving, self-driving cars, that 3,000 people a year would be saved. How many people endorse that? So some of you are already thinking of the flip side. So utilitarianism just says, that's fine, right? Unless you're one of the other 90% who were killed by a machine. People seem to be okay with another human making a mistake and that person's error. From a philosophical standpoint, not because, I'm okay with you killing me. But But they have models for how to deal with that. Our legal system has models of how to deal with that. We can hold those people accountable. But if a failure of a machine causes a death, then we feel a little bit uneasy about that. And so in polls, that figure tends to be a little bit more than 50%. People would like to see half of those deaths go away before they would start endorsing widespread replacement of human-driven cars. And there's a website, and again, I'll give you the link so you can post it, people can play with it. At MIT, they have some thought experiments. Everybody's familiar with the trolley problem, whether you turn the handle and move the car to hit the person versus the hand. Well, so they set up a series of scenarios. Say a car is coming, and there's a crowd of people. You can swerve, but then you'll hit this person. Or here, there's a person in the road. You'll swerve, but you'll hit a wall, and you'll die. Or here, there's a crowd of people. You swerve and incur your own death to save a crowd of people versus just one person. And so it presents several of these scenarios, and then it gives you, there are three males, two children, you know, and has different demographics, and then different outcomes of the passengers versus the bystanders. And it runs through several different ones, and I'll show you what the output looks like here. So these are my this is my evaluation. So it tells me, and my results, the blue thing is the decisions that I made versus what all others who have taken this test do. And so my results, my most saved character was a child, you know, in all the scenarios. Most of my decisions defaulted to avoid killing children. I feel pretty good about myself there. The most killed character was an elderly male. Maybe I don't feel so good about that. Then the decisions about saving more lives, does it matter whether we're saving one person versus saving a group of people? I tend to not move towards groups as much as the general, but we're the same. Here, protecting passengers versus protecting bystanders, most people felt right in the middle, where I tended to say protecting passengers doesn't matter versus bystanders. That, you know, it doesn't matter if the child's in the car or the child's a pedestrian or the child's a pedestrian. I defaulted towards saving the child. For whatever reason, most people said it didn't matter. I also got in saving more lives versus passengers. Upholding the law, whether there was a red light and you would have to go through a red light, you know, and cross over immediate or not. And so I'm pretty close with everybody else, slightly mattering about upholding the law. Here's where I really differed. Avoiding intervention. So most of my decisions said, don't swerve. You know, don't make a change in the trolley problem, it's pulling the lever, that in for whatever reason I had an intuition that not intervening was more important to me than it was the general public. Maybe just two or three more slides. Here, my gender preference for females versus males. I think this is some noise in the data. So, because they give about 12 scenarios, and I did not consciously pick males versus females. I think that I picked, you know, some of those other reasons, and it just happened that the females were, you know,
one of those. Sure.
That's old school.
Sure.
Species preference, humans. So I'm way on the side of humans. And I every single time, you know, save a person over an animal. And age preference, I was almost exactly the same as everybody else. Fitness preference. I tended to prefer large people over fit people. Again, I think that's some noise in the data. And social value, whether someone was like a criminal running out, you know, out of a bank, you know, versus a physician. And I went way over to the, you know, anybody who has a doctorate, needs to be taken care of. And so that's the test. Like I said, I'll post the link to that so you can play with this test on your own and see. So I think I'm out of time. But if there's time for questions.
Yeah. Q&A now, and please try to frame your as a question. Don't get into a long digression, and because we need to get out of here, you know, they want to close this place by 9. So, Skip, do you have a question?
Yeah. No. I tried to ask him this before. Let's see if it fits.
Did I avoid your question before? Or did science
No comment. If artificial intelligence is human, what will impel it to obey these laws that we set up for it? Because humans certainly don't.
So can we design something that won't escape the rules that we set up for it? So I believe that's a no. So by definition, there is an entire field of research called AI safety that just seeks to solve this problem. And so most of the proposed solutions lie in there not being one single smart machine that controls everything like Mycroft in the Heinlein novel. That there would be a population of intelligent machines, and some would behave better than others, just like our society. But there's one additional thing. If you want to go to Google, there's a concept called a utility function that dictates the core behavior of an agent. And so the question is, can an agent modify its own utility function? And if you search for that question, you'll get some really interesting hits. Yes? You need a microphone?
I just gave a talk in Seattle about appropriate use of technology in education. Interesting stuff. And lots of ways that here you have a certain amount of setup talking to people about background, artificial intelligence, and ethics. So one of the things that I've had issues with is getting people sufficiently knowledgeable on the subject to actually have this conversation. Is there any way that we can actually, we had this big setup to even start this discussion. So, have you found good ways to actually get to that point where you can have meaningful conversations? Because if you can't get to that point, then you can't have that discussion.
Part of it is the audience. I think that if you know something about the audience and the audience is basically monolithic on their background. So as I said, I attempted to tailor the discussion based on the assumption that most of you will have spent a non-trivial amount of time reading about philosophy, and that a lot of the things, so I just say utilitarianism, and everybody, most of you, are going to know what I'm talking about. And so some of those sorts of ideas. At university, there are prerequisites for courses, and so I have an expectation of what the classroom knows and doesn't know. Personally, I think, when it comes to this kind of stuff, if civics were still being taught in high school, we could bypass a lot of that ground information.
Some people have suggested that true human-level machine intelligence would be the product of machine learning and machine evolution, mm-hmm. of existing machine development. And I was wondering if you would comment on whether you agree with that, and also, given that the machine would not have the imperatives of territoriality or reproduction, that they might, in essence, be immune to a lot of these
negative traits that humans carry. So not everybody agrees that the goals are the same. I'm of the school with researchers like Ben Gertzel in China and Helmut Schmutter in Europe that the goal is superhuman intelligence. You know, we don't want machines that are doing the same things that silly people are doing. We've got enough of those. We want machines in the same way that we now use, you know, machines to help us augment things that we couldn't do, like vehicles. I couldn't have made it here tonight if I were just on foot, you know, based on where I live. So we want machines that can tackle tasks that we can't, that can sequence genomes, that can cure diseases, you know, things that take teams of researchers decades, if something was sufficiently intelligent, might be able to figure it out in, you know, a matter of days or weeks.
Okay.
Yes?
So, just a quick question. So, can you comment on, I guess, artificial intelligence and sentience? Does it warrant discussion, and is it even...
So that's that problem of other minds, and so there's a big chart with like a Venn diagram, if you're familiar, you know, overlapping circles, and so there are several different concepts like self-awareness, so intelligence, self-awareness, sentience, sapience, and, you know, which are necessary and sufficient conditions of others, which are wholly entailed within each other, and so I think... The word that you used is common in the culture, sentience, but among researchers, that just means that being able to perceive input, that my dog is sentient by the cognitive science definition, because it can perceive sensory input and act on that sensory input. What distinguishes humans is sapience, and that's why we're called Homo sapiens, is that we have sapient thought, that we could reason about reasoning. Did I answer your question, or did
I?
No.
Yeah, that's just my question.
Just a little digression. Isn't there a more immediate problem of humanity deliberately abusing the potential for robotics for, I guess, their own purposes, and is there any potential to somehow regulate, I mean, if AI becomes fairly great technology, how do you stop it from being, military robots going to the earth or something like
that? I don't think we can stop governments from using it, you know, any technology. We can just try to make sure that it's not monopolized, you know, by one or you know, a small number of governments to oppress them.
I think the question is, how do you teach a computer's morals so that, you know, they won't take over?
So if we have done our philosophy well and we understand the things like game theory, you know, that treating others well is in our best interest. You know, so if we honestly believe that those ethics are rationally true, then as something that is far smarter than we are, we'll come to that same conclusion. You know, why do so many of us care about the treatment of animals or the mistreatment of animals? So, but one of the concerns is these superhuman intelligences wouldn't care for us because we would just be like pets to it. But many of us do have, you know, a lot of ethical concerns about how animals are treated.
Well, this seems to me to approach a question you hear a lot in sort of popular discussion about this. The concern about machines becoming self-replicating and self-improving. That this seems to really concern Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and a lot of people who say that perhaps this may bring us to a very dangerous point because this self-improving, self-duplicating machine may overcome our programming, our moral senses of our models that we may program, may begin to develop its own sense of logic, ones that we will not understand because of reaching AI,
right.
And then may turn on us in a way because we become insignificant, and not destroy us like the Terminator robots, but simply cut off survival mechanisms. This is expressed by Stephen Hawking and other people.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if you...
And Hawking's, and specifically Elon Musk's concerns on this matter, I don't want to disturb you more than necessary.
Well, I'm not disturbed.
among people that do research in AI safety, this philosopher David Chalmers. Anybody familiar with David Chalmers? Harvard, okay. So he talks a lot about this stuff. And I've met him on a couple of occasions. And he gave me his elevator speech on Quali when we were in an elevator. We said it's in a hotel. So his concern, let's say that we figure it out. We got superhuman intelligence that we've constructed. So we are able to construct something that is far more intelligent than us, and it's safe. It cares about people. As part of its utility function, that it's either incapable of changing, or it has concluded that it doesn't want to change. So great. We think that's the perfect scenario, right? Well, if we could create something far more intelligent than us, what happens if AI creates AI plus? And it may care about AI, but AI plus may not care about us. So if you Google AI plus and David Chalmers, there are some speeches that he's given.
So,
have a few quick questions. First is, some of my students tell me that they are learning and programming in a language that is dedicated specifically for building AIs. Do you know anything about this?
There are several languages that we didn't have time tonight, but I actually was going to show you some live code that we didn't have time for. So, do you remember what they were saying?
I do not.
Okay. So, Prolog, Lisp.
So they're out there, but I just wanted, I was curious to see where that was going, because I've always wondered what that was or how something would be more suited to that.
And the examples that I'm not going to be able to show you,
sure.
Although maybe after they chase us out of the building, I can show you after.
Sure.
But yeah, so it's based on first order logic.
First order logic, okay.
Like the modus ponens and stuff.
The real question I had is if you're dealing with sapience or sentience or whatever term you're doing, language you're put on that, it sounds like you're dealing with a mind on mind transaction, right? And I'm just wondering, how is that different from, say, like a lawyer trying to persuade a jury for, I hire out web developers, right? I'm hiring them or using their mind as a tool to achieve a particular task. And I'm just wondering, like, how is this different, in the context of that case?
Well, that feeds into the definition that I have that ethics is the mind's behavior and actions as with respect to its effect on other minds.
So my question is yes. Sort of related to the one the questions ago about AIs that are superhuman intelligent might think of us more like pets or AI plus. Do you think there's a possibility of that sort of being solved through like integration? I know there's some people believe that once a computer become intelligent enough to like fully model the human mind, they might be able to integrate with it, and maybe we could become superhuman intelligence ourselves.
So that's actually my belief of where this is going, is that there's not going to be some separate machine intelligence arise. That we're already augmenting ourselves with earpieces and smartphones and the stuff that I can call up just by having an iPhone in my hand that I don't have to remember. If that stuff were eventually embedded in a heads-up display in your glasses or as a contact lens that Google now has, believe it or not, and wear contact lenses and see an overview of augmented.
So ultimately, this just becomes an immortality project, do you think?
Absolutely, and Google has a whole division headed up by Ray Kurzweil.
We have time for one more question, but I just want to recommend for all of you who are interested in this and like science fiction, Isaac Asimov's book, it's called I, Robot, and it has nothing to do with the movie.
It's
a sequence of short stories in which chronologically his robots, his computers, get little more and more sophisticated, and so that there's paradoxes involved and problems to be solved. because of the three laws of robotics. So I really recommend it. One more question.
You talked tonight about teaching AI to behave ethically towards humanity. Could you discuss a bit about any obligation ethically that humanity might have towards these machines as they achieve?
Yeah, and that's why my definition talks about minds' responsibilities to other minds. That means machines' responsibility to human and humans' responsibilities to machines. And why I also brought up that concept of the problem of other minds, that do we know this machine, is self-aware? That if we don't even know if other people are self-aware, if it quacks like a duck and swims like a duck and flies like a duck, then we should ethically assume it's a duck. We should assume if it behaves as if it's sapient, then we should treat it that way. Because the flip side, of not doing so, the consequences of abusing that would be, I think, onerous.
Okay, can you just talk to them afterwards?
I will.
That's all the time that we have, and thanks, Dr. Davis.